So let's continue commenting on the section from line 58 to 97 or something like that. So that's his basic argument that it's not an objection in principle. Now, in part he is obliged to say this because in the United States all free men can vote at this time. So you see, 100 years before, he could say, well, nowhere in the world do poor people vote or poor men vote. So let's not talk about it. It's ridiculous. That's no longer possible because in the United States, all free men can vote. Women cannot vote. Slaves cannot vote. But at this time, all free men can vote, which includes a small number of black voters who are free. So the change in the political situation and the new American Republic, which is doing things in its own way, changes the arguments because he's obliged to talk about universal suffrage because it exists somewhere. And in France at this moment, they have universal suffrage. Now, he doesn't use this example because all the people he's talking to consider France to be hell. The French Revolution to be horrible thing. So he doesn't need to persuade the House of Commons we must not do like in France, because they already think that. Yeah. But in fact, at this time, this is the time when the French Parliament abolishes slavery. And this wonderful moment, I may have mentioned this to you before, it's a wonderful moment when the representative of some Caribbean island comes in and said, I propose that slavery be abolished. And the president of the French Parliament says, the gentleman proposes that slavery be abolished. I will not insult you by asking for a debate. There is no debate, and it's unanimously. I will not insult you by asking for a debate. That's j'ai oublié qui c'est, mais un gars très intéressant. Okay, so let's continue here. So he is being very, it's very rhetorical. Yeah, he could say just, well, if workers are comfortable, it's fine for them to vote. But he doesn't say that. He's doing his speech. He likes his speech. He says, if employment were always plentiful, if wages were always high, if food was always cheap, if, you know, il fait son show, hein? On a compris. But the House of Commons. Rhetoric and speech giving is a very valued skill. If you're in an elite family interest in politics, you have a teacher to teach you rhetoric, to teach you how to give speeches. Just like in ancient Greece, the big speech makers. This is something which has been. It's not so important today in general, because quite often today, if you're a politician, you need to be very fast. The journalists are very aggressive, and you have to answer very fast. The soundbite is very important. Not always, you know. During election time in France, you have speeches which are 2 hours long. In Britain, this doesn't exist. Yeah, it doesn't exist. Yeah, but 2.5 hours if you're Mélenchon. But 2 hours for even Macron gives quite long speeches at election times. In Britain, we don't have this anymore. You know, 20 minutes. That's it. Yeah. Speech giving can still be important, but it was, of course, more important at the time. So, he's going to continue and talk a little bit about the United States. I'm going to read this section to you and then come back to it. Universal suffrage exists in the United States without producing any very frightful consequences. And I do not believe that the people of those states or of any part of the world are in any good quality naturally superior to our own countrymen. But unhappily, the labouring classes in England and all old countries are occasionally in a state of great distress. Some of the causes of distress are, I fear, beyond the control of the government. We know what effect distress produces, even on people more intelligent than the great body of the labouring classes can possibly be. We know that it makes even wise men irritable, unreasonable, credulous, eager for immediate relief, heedless of remote consequences. There is no quackery in medicine, religion, or politics which may not impose even on a powerful mind when that mind has been disordered by pain or fear. It is therefore no reflection on the poorer class of Englishmen who are not and who cannot. In the nature of things, be highly educated to say that distress produces on them its natural effects, those effects which it would produce on the Americans or on any other people, that it blinds their judgments, that it inflames their passions, that it makes them prone to believe those who would flatter them and to distrust those who would serve them. For the sake, therefore, of the whole society, for the sake of the labouring class themselves, I hold it to be clearly expedient that in a country like this, the right of suffrage should depend on a pecuniary qualification. Okay, so look at the very last words. What is a pecuniary qualification? Yeah, money. And so he's saying that it is a good thing that people can only vote if they have money. So this is interesting because today in the 21st century, some people think that rich people are much more important. But if they're politicians, they do not say this publicly. Yeah? A few years ago, I believe somebody said, il y a les gens bien et les gens qui ne sont rien. But he did not say it in a public televised speech. He said it when he thought there was no microphone. But at this time, this is not a problem. He says, it is, in the last sentence he says, what is really good for workers is that they don't vote. It's a Lego. That's what she's saying. Yeah. For the sake of the whole society, for the sake of the labouring classes themselves. Yeah. So it's good for you not to vote. Yeah. Because when you're poor, you can't think straight. You get all passionate. Oh, you know how passionately. He's talking in euphemisms. This is, at the time they are rioting in the centre of Bristol. Two people are killed in the north. And they're talking. They're saying, "Yeah, more lords or none. Yeah, let's get rid of the house." Oh dear. Yeah. So it's a very and the way that he sees it, just like most members of Parliament at the time, when there is a big riot, he says, "Oh, well, the poor people. They're so emotional. They keep getting. Yeah, they're not like us. We are members of Parliament. We are rational. But the poor people, they're all emotional. Oh, they're so emotional." Now, of course, every radical movement in history is described in this way. Feminists were always described as being mad, hysterical. Yeah, it happens to every group. So there's nothing surprising really here. Have a look at line 77. This is a rhetoric. Yeah, it would be fine for ordinary people to vote. Unhappily. Not in this case. And so he says that the labouring classes in England and all old countries. What are the old countries? Do you have any idea who the old countries are? Well, who are the new countries? America is a new country. Australia is not yet a new country, but soon will be. Well, another 50 years. So the old countries are, you know, France, Italy, Germany, yeah? the old countries. In fact, at this time, there is not a lot of poverty among the colonists in America. It's quite a rich place. Yeah. But the other thing you say that you notice that he talks about poverty, it's very sad. There's a lot of poor people. So he does not consider this to be a government problem. Now, this is not surprising. The number of questions which are considered to be a government problem has risen very slowly and gradually for 200 years. And I can give you an example. Perhaps you remember a couple of years ago there was some sort of pandemic. Do you remember? COVID? Yeah, you remember? Yeah. On ne s'est pas rendu compte, mais vos petits-enfants vont vous demander si c'est vrai que vous étiez là. C'était énorme, c'était un truc historique mondial. Hein. Bon, je sais que vous n'avez pas encore des petits enfants. J'espère pour vous. Okay. Moi non plus d'ailleurs. You notice that every government in the world, some good, some bad, took radical measures. Yeah? In many countries, you weren't allowed out of your house. It's never been heard of. However, about 100 years ago, in 1919 to 23, there was another pandemic, the Spanish flu, which killed millions of people, and the government didn't do much. It was not considered to be a government problem. Yet the number of problems which are considered government problems is rising. Of course people agree or disagree on how good the government in France was during the pandemic. But if the government had said, it's not our problem, that was not possible. It was not politically possible. And in the same way, when Macaulay is speaking of poverty, he says, well, you know, poverty, what can you do? It's not a government problem. Whereas after 1945, certainly in Britain, the welfare state, it is considered to be a government problem. Now, they may deal with it very well or very badly, but they cannot say it's not our problem. So here we are seeing, in the speech, we are seeing a reflection of what point in history is he talking from. So this is there's a lot of things you can say about this. You can talk about why he is using this argument and the context. But the context is the immediate context. There are riots across the country and he's terrified of revolution. And indeed, in another part of this speech, je sais que il y a la moitié d'entre vous qui ont lu la moitié du discours, mais vous allez le lire. Elsewhere in this speech, he says, I am afraid of revolution. He says it in exactly those words. I mentioned the Duke of Wellington talking about that. Let's have a look in a little more detail what he says is happening to these poor people. Well, one might consider this tone to be rather patronizing. What's the problem with poor people? Well, because they're hungry, they are irritable, they are unreasonable, they are credulous. Yeah. So what? If you are commenting on this, you have to comment on what is his attitude. Now, that's not too difficult to find, but you must remember to ask yourself the question. If you don't ask what is his attitude, then you won't say. His attitude is, it's not that he thinks it's wonderful that people are hungry. But, he thinks it's sad, but it's not a government problem. And he thinks that, he thinks they are very much inferior to him. He doesn't need to say it. He doesn't even need to say it. So the rioting and the campaigns and the Corresponding Society and all that, and the Birmingham Political Union, he considers to be an over-emotional response to poverty. And 94, the poor people become prone to believe those who flatter them. Alors là, c'est un très vieux refrain, ils sont manipulés, et puis ils sont manipulés, hein. C'est les gens de l'extérieur qui viennent organiser des émeutes. Je ne sais pas si vous avez déjà essayé de débarquer dans un quartier, organiser une émeute, faut se lever tôt, hein. Pas facile. Yeah. He's talking about the people who flatter the poor. He's talking about the political leaders like Atwood, who organized the Birmingham Political Union, who says, yes, you are poor people, you deserve more rights. But in the opinion of Macaulay, who is much more conservative, they're just being flattered, c'est de la flatterie, ils sont manipulés par des gens, même certains qui sont ici dans la Chambre des communes, qui devraient savoir mieux faire. So these are the sort of things he's coming up with. Now, he needs to persuade the maximum number of people in the House of Commons to vote for this reform bill. So this means he needs some people who would like a more radical reform bill to vote for this reform bill, and some people who don't really want much change at all. So he's trying to bring people together, and during this speech, he will try to reassure the Conservatives. He will try. Don't worry, this is not the beginning of more reforms. So let us continue after line 98. But, sir, every argument which would induce me to oppose universal suffrage induces me to support the plan which is now before us. Now, in this now he is talking to the conservatives. He's saying, look, you're a conservative, okay? You hate your universal suffrage, but you can vote for this bill. Because I am against universal suffrage, I'm voting for this reform. Whereas many conservatives said, if you vote for any reform, that's the beginning, yeah? Afterwards, there will be many, many more. Which, of course, is sometimes the case. I am opposed to universal suffrage because I think it would produce a destructive revolution. I support this reform bill, because I am sure that it is our best security against a revolution. Okay, so it's very clear. And he's not talking in the abstract, he's talking in a context where there are many angry protests across the country. The noble paymaster of the forces hinted delicately indeed and remotely at this subject. He spoke of the dangers of disappointing the expectations of the nation. And now, another example which I forgot to give you. The Prime Minister received a letter from the leader of a section of the army saying, we refuse to attack the demonstrations for the Reform Act. Now, when the army begins to disobey, that's really bad news for the status quo. That doesn't mean it's a revolutionary situation, but it's the beginnings. Yeah. So this was another reason why they were extremely frightened. I think I have some details on that. The problem here is I have too many. I have too many notes, which is why I. Four people were hanged in Bristol. On the 5th of November in 1831, I think this may be during this crisis, instead of burning Guy Fawkes, they burnt some bishops who are in the House of Lords. They are bishops in there. Yeah. In Birmingham, the meeting had 200,000 people present. So these are the sort of situation. Okay, I'm going to jump the section up to line 120. What he says is one of the people who one of the other members who defended this bill has been accused of threatening the House. In fact, the member, he said, yeah, oh well, if we don't do this, there will be a revolution. And somebody says, you're threatening the House. And so in this part, Macaulay says, there have been many other instances in the past when members have warned about the terrible consequences and not been accused of threatening the House. So it's slightly less interesting. Let's continue on line 121. I do in my conscience believe that unless the plan proposed or some similar plan be speedily adopted, great and terrible calamities will befall us. Entertaining this opinion, I think myself bound to state it not as a threat, but as a reason. I support this bill because it will improve our institutions, but I support it also because it tends to preserve them. That we may exclude those whom it is necessary to exclude, we must admit those whom it may be safe to admit. At present, we oppose the schemes of revolutionists with only one quarter of our proper force. We say And we say justly that it is not by mere numbers, but by property and intelligence that the nation ought to be governed. Yet saying this, we exclude from all share in the government great masses of property and intelligence, great numbers of those who are most interested in preserving tranquility and who know best how to preserve it. We do more. We drive over to the side of revolution those whom we shut out from our power. Is this a time when the cause of law and order can spare one of its natural allies? So there are two arguments he used here. First of all, he repeats himself a lot. Yeah, this is rhetoric, it's not surprising. First of all, he says, if we don't pass this reform bill, if we don't have a reform, then there will be calamities, great and terrible calamities. Alors juste pour la question de méthodologie, rappelez-vous que dans l'examen, vous citez justement 3-4 mots ici, 3-4 mots là-bas. Ce n'est pas une bonne idée de citer 4 lignes de suite. Ça donne l'impression que vous les citez parce que vous ne l'avez pas compris. C'est souvent le cas. Malheureusement, l'examinateur est plus malin que vous. Donc, ce n'est pas trop la peine. C'est tentant, mais donnez l'impression que vous savez des choses. Quand vous ne les savez pas, il y a peu de chance. Donc ici, ce que vous devez faire, c'est « He speaks of great calamities. He is talking of revolution. This is a moment when there was a revolution in France the year before. When the riots, the Captain Swing riots, were also the year before. The elites and the members of parliament have many reasons to be frightened. » C'est excellent comme un paragraphe de commentaire sur les trois mots. Yeah, you need to go outside. Now he uses another argument, again a pragmatic argument, a practical argument. He says, what's the problem? See, if we refuse this very moderate reform, it is very moderate, after the Reform Act, it takes a long time, but after the Reform Act, 8% of the population could vote. Now, especially today, we think, well, that's not. It feels like not a lot, yeah? Now, to some people at the time, it feels like a big reform because there are members of parliament for Manchester, Birmingham, for the big towns. There are no more members of parliament who can simply buy their place. So it's a change, yeah? But from the point of view of broadening the suffrage, well, not it's not 4%, it's 8%. Well, thank you. So like you don't have to be a billionaire, just a millionaire. Okay, thank you. I'll phone up my millionaire friends. But he says there's a problem here. He says, listen, everybody, the problem is if we refuse this little reform, what we are doing is we are uniting the reformers and the revolutionaries. They're all going to work together because we refuse everything. If we accept this little reform, we can have lots of reformers with us against the revolutionaries. Yeah? It's a matter of where are we drawing the line. Yeah? If we refuse any reform, then the only people with us will be the real conservatives, and against us will be the radicals who want revolution like in France, and also the much bigger numbers who want some change, and they will begin to listen to the revolutionaries. If we give them nothing, they will begin to listen to the revolutionaries. This opens up the universal question, whenever there is a fight for social change, what is an acceptable compromise? I don't have the answer, I just have the question, yeah? There's always a problem of what is an acceptable compromise. So that's what he's saying. And so he's saying, in the present situation, we are against the revolutionaries, but the most people do not support us against the revolutionaries because they're not getting anything at all. So that's no good. Okay, let me just look at one more tiny bit at the very, very end. Line 570. Sorry, question? It was medical or something?
Yes.
Okay. That's a good enough reason. It's not just to go and have a beer.
No.
Okay, well, that's good. That's okay then. That's okay. That's fine. as if you would say yes. No, that's fine. That's fine. Yeah, I know things like that can happen. So look at line 517. Now he's putting on his show, and you know these are very comfortable people. You know, the members of parliament, and they like a good show. Yeah, they don't have Netflix or Amazon Prime. Yeah, so you know, a good speech. Oh, you were very good. You were very good. You know, you can imagine that after the speech, you know, some of the people who agree with him. Oh yeah, have a drink. Yeah, have some brandy. You were very good. But also the Conservatives. Oh, Trump. Well, I don't agree with you, but that was a very good speech. Have another brandy. You know, brandy. It's mostly about brandy. Okay, 570. This is his conclusion. Reform, everybody, listen to me. Reform that you may preserve now. Now, therefore, while everything at home and abroad forebodes ruin to those who persist in a hopeless struggle against the spirit of the age. Now, while the crash of the proudest throne of the continent is still resounding in our ears. Now, while the roof of a British palace affords an ignominious shelter to the exiled heir of 40 kings, now, while we see on every side ancient institutions subverted and great societies dissolved, now, while the heart of England is still sound, now, while old feelings and old associations retain a power and a charm which too may soon pass away, now, in this your accepted time, now, in this your day of salvation, take counsel not of prejudice, not of party spirit, not of the ignominious pride of a fatal consistency, but take counsel of history, of reason, of the ages which are past, of the signs of this most portentous time. So he's getting very, very worked up. When is the right time for reform? Because he speaks in the previous thing. Many people say, oh yes, I'm not against reform, but it's not the right time. Nope. Every time anybody suggests any change, there is always somebody to say it's not the right time. And for some people, it's never the right time. And so he gives some reasons why now is the time. At home and abroad, ruin is coming to those who fight the spirit of the age. So he's saying that this reform is in the spirit of the age. There are too many people who are no longer ready to accept that some people buy their place in Parliament. There are too many people. It's the spirit of the ages for reform. Not for universal, for reform. And abroad as well. Yeah. In France and so on. Now is the time to make this decision. Now, while, line 573, the crash of the proudest throne in the continent, of the continent, France. The French throne, the proudest throne in the continent, has just fallen. Alors, alors j'ai oublié le détail, franchement, de Louis-Philippe, mais c'est un autre... ils ont viré un roi parce qu'il était trop fier, justement. Ils ont mis un autre qui était plutôt mou. Le terme historique technique, c'est mou. Voilà. And the old king, the king who was overthrown, where is he? He's in England. He's hiding in England. And this is what he says. He says, now is the time... while the roof of a British palace affords an ignominious shelter to the exiled heir of 40 kings. Yeah, is it Charles qui a été viré? Yeah, thank you. Okay, Charles, who was overthrown by a revolution, where is he? He's hiding in a palace in Britain. And so Macaulay is saying to the members of parliament, look at the world. Yeah, this guy who didn't want change, where is he? He's hiding in England. Do you want to have to go and hide in France? Now is the
time.
And so what should they do? They should not think about party spirit. Yeah, don't vote against this just because you're a Tory and you've always been a Tory and your party is the Tories and you love the Tories. Be pragmatic. Think of the situation. He's saying the situation is desperate. It is urgent. So that's the parliamentary rhetoric going on there. Now, I'm going to come back to that, but I want to go on to the story of what happened next. And this is important from a general point of view of history, of course, but also because even when you analyze the documents, what is important about this document is it comes at a particular moment in the rise of suffrage. Now, the rise of suffrage was not automatic. You get sort of, let's do it from your point of view. 1832, a very, very, very long wait. 1867, not such a long wait. 1884, and then up there for 1918, 1928 at the top. So it's a process that led to a modern democratic government, although in a rather bizarre situation in Britain, because until 1999, the House of Lords was dominated by the aristocracy. It's kind of unusual, yeah, because in 1950, everybody said, oh yeah, Britain is a democratic country. But the House of Lords, the second chamber, was dominated by the aristocracy. Now, the House of Lords cannot make laws, but they could block laws, so they had some power. So that was rather unusual, and certainly in France, what's going on? You know, you've got aristocrats still have power. Even today, the aristocrats have the aristocratic control of the House of Lords was eliminated in 1999. Vous aviez pas remarqué, mais je vous assure. Il reste quelques aristocrates dans le coin de la chambre des lords. Et des évêques. Vous ne savez pas où les mettre. Ils sont là dans le coin. So it's a rather bizarre system, but nevertheless, we're in a situation which will lead to democracy. Partly because of the enormous movements. If there had been no enormous riots, Macaulay would not have made the speech. Yeah? He is not isolated from history. At the same time, the social movements did not in themselves bring about the widening of suffrage. So the reason I'm saying that is to understand the position of this speech, you also need to know what happened next. And what happened next was absolutely not automatic advance. You see, we had to wait 35 years for the second reform bill. Et si vous trouvez si on vous donne un extrait de Macaulay à commenter, il serait tout à fait normal d'évoquer la deuxième loi 35 ans après, parce que ce discours, ça fait partie d'un processus. Alors vous n'allez pas faire 10 minutes sur le deuxième, mais l'évoquer absolument, absolument. So eventually, there you go. The Lords allowed the Reform Bill through in 1832, and in its final form, because it kept changing, the Reform Act increased the electorate from about 350,000 people to 650,000 people, 9% of the total adult population. C'est quelqu'un d'autre qui a fait ce diapo, c'est pour ça que c'est marqué 18% de tous les hommes. Mais moi, je trouve que c'est plus normal de dire 9% de tous les adultes. C'est la même chose, c'est le même chiffre. Mais bon, ça donne l'impression que les femmes ont un problème, comme c'est écrit là. C'est pas moi, c'est de l'autre. OK, in Scotland, dans une autre université, in Scotland, it increased the electorate to about 6% of the total adult population. Now, as you can imagine, of all the people who were involved in fighting for suffrage, some people were happy. The factory owners in Birmingham were quite happy. There was now a Member of Parliament for Birmingham. And the landowners had a little bit less power. And the industrialists had a little bit more power. This was important. There were a lot of laws being discussed which would help commerce. So they needed representatives. However, the working class people were rapidly rather disappointed because it didn't bring much. And they were kind of happy in a way. I mean, they were happy that people could no longer buy places in Parliament. But nevertheless, it was quite rather disappointing for the poorer people. And this was one of the main reasons that led to the establishment of a new movement in 1838, Chartism. And Chartism is the first ever national working class mass political movement. I already mentioned the campaign to abolish slavery, which was the first mass national political campaign. But the movement to abolish slavery was a campaign for one aim, to abolish slavery. Chartism became a general, like a political party, a movement which had a position on all political questions. And Chartism was at the centre of politics for at least 10 years. It began in 1838 with the establishment of the Charter. And the Charter had six demands. Votes for all men over 21. It's interesting, there was a debate, and there was a moment when it was almost votes for all people over 21. And at the last moment it was lost, that decision. There's a fascinating history. Number two, secret ballots. Yeah, it's essential, yeah. How can you... if you give workers the vote... It's impossible if they have to vote while the factory owner watches them. It can't happen. Number three, electoral districts of equal size. Yeah, that every member of parliament should have 100,000 votes, and nobody should have 25 votes. Yeah. Number four, anybody can be an MP. You don't have to be rich. And therefore, number five, MPs should have a salary. MPs having a salary is a very important democratic demand, because if MPs do not have a salary, only rich people can become members of parliament. And finally, annual elections for parliament. Every year, that sounds like quite a lot, doesn't it? But that was the idea at the time. Now, I'll just remind you that the many, many poor people thought that if poor people got the vote, poverty would disappear. People were prepared to die for these demands, like I say, today we say, yeah, elections, okay, I suppose they're a good thing, but we're a little blasé about it in general, not everybody, because they'd never seen democracy, they considered it to be bigger. The Chartist movement was enormous, especially in the industrial towns. It had several newspapers. For general political movements before the arrival of the internet, if you don't have a newspaper, you don't have a movement. You must have a place where debates and information are regularly produced. And also, a newspaper will allow you to build a movement, because you sell your newspaper, and so you must sell it. If it's free, if you give it out free, you don't know who's interested. If you sell it, you know who's interested, because they'll buy it. And even better, you see, if you buy it every week, then after you've bought four, I said, would you like to take two and sell the other one? You might go to prison, so I can test if she's serious or not. Because when you have a radical demand, all your friends say, oh yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, it's good, I agree with you. Say, will you do something? No, I'm busy. Well, it was the same in the 19th century. Here you have a picture of this is a membership card. This is a membership card of the National Charter Association. Now, in many ways, it was a political, it was a mass political party, but mass political parties did not exist. So it was they invented it. They invented a mass political party. And their slogan, truth is our guide. Yes, so very high level slogans. The first thing they did is that they established a petition, the 1839 petition, more than 1.2 million signatures. And they arrived in Parliament with the petition on a carriage. Now, first of all, you must notice that this is much more impressive than today. It's difficult to get a million signatures today, but people just have to click on the website to sign, yeah. Here, you had to send hundreds of people from village to village, hoping they would find some food when they arrived, to get signatures. It's an extremely impressive thing. And when they got to the Parliament, the Speaker said, okay, shall we discuss this question? And they voted not to discuss it, not even to discuss it. Yeah, so that was pretty negative. And this caused a crisis in the Chartists, and people began to suggest many other tactics. Instead of the petition, let's do something else. And somebody said, well, what we need is arms. and in two towns in particular, there were a few hundred Chartists in arms. Naturally, of course, they were no competition for the army, so they were rapidly crushed. Yeah, they lost very quickly. The second possibility was what they called the Grand National Holiday. And in 1842, there was the first ever general strike in Britain, organized by the Charters, striking for the Charter. And there were many other tactics, there were many other ideas, which I will tell you at the moment. In general, we divide the currents in Chartism at this time between physical force Chartists and moral force Chartists. This is not the question of being violent or not. That's not the problem. It's a very 21st century way of looking at things. Moral force means we will persuade rich people that it is better for them. Yeah, by persuasion, by arguments. And physical force is we will find a way to force them. Perhaps a general strike. That was the most popular one. Or perhaps, you know, we will boycott the shops of all those who do not support the Charter. All of this is physical force, yeah. So it could include violence, but that was not the main point. The conservative newspapers at the time, of course, as always, were mocking. So here's Punch magazine in 1848. And this is a physical force Chartist who is putting on his armour, which is made of things you can find in a kitchen. They tried a second petition in 1842, over 3 million signatures. Again, as you can imagine, the Parliament refused it. And this was the moment which led to the first general strike in Britain. There you have a picture of the riots during the general strike. There is a statue at Preston, is in the north of England near Manchester. And I was there just a few weeks ago, and I saw in the centre of town there is a monument to the Chartists who were killed. I didn't know it was there during the strike. I took a photograph. And I should have put it on my slide, but I didn't. But never mind. Maybe next year. Oh, no, next year I'm not going to be here. There you go. Too late. You missed it. Now, because this was an enormous movement with weekly newspapers in different regions, it became one of the most creative places to think about how to change society. And there were many, many ideas. Temperance Chartism was a group of people who said, well, the problem is alcohol. If we persuade workers to stop drinking alcohol, then the elite will realize that we deserve the vote. Now, it sounds rather naive, it's true, but it was a real thing. Now temperance will become an important tradition in the British working class movement. First of all, you must separate. It has no connection with what happened in America. To understand this, you have to remember that this is a time when finding somebody who had drunk so much alcohol that they were dead in the streets was not unusual. So the campaign against alcohol was not the kind of campaign you have today against alcohol. It was really against something where people were dying regularly because of it. It will continue for a long time. My great-grandfather was an activist for temperance. It was quite a big movement at the time, working class activists for temperance. So that was one tendency in temperance Chartism. Other Chartists said, well, the problem is education. The problem is that people have learned to be, subservient. So we need different schools. Let's set up Chartist schools. So they established Chartist schools, and the Chartist schools were some of the first in the world where they taught the same thing to boys and girls. At the time, this was something really, really very, very impressive. They also established Chartist churches. They said the Church of England is against the Charter, so we need new churches. They established new Christian churches. So it's obviously, you can see how powerful a movement it was, because it could make these completely new ideas. Can you imagine setting up a new church? You need to be very ambitious. So that was the situation. The last major attempt to influence the government took place in 1848 with an enormous meeting on Kennington Common, and they were aiming to then march on the House of Parliament and occupy it. From the point of view of a historian, this is the 1848, enormous event in 1848. Now, what is different for the historian between the enormous event in 1832 and the enormous event in 1848? What is different about the documents you can have? What kind of documents might you have in 1848 that you cannot have in 1832? Yeah, it's a bit unfair, really. When was photography invented? A long time ago. Yeah, you're not sure, are you? A long time ago. In fact, the Daguerre, c'est un français, hein, qui est le premier. Enfin, il y a plusieurs premiers, mais Daguerre. We have photographs of Paris in 1830. The 1830 revolution, we have photographs. But England was a bit later, and here we have a photograph of the great Chartist meeting on Kennington Common in London, April the 10th, 1848. So, which is, because we're used to seeing photographs of, 1880 onwards, But 1840, this was a very early photograph, yeah? When he showed it to his friends, they didn't believe him. Well, what do you mean you have a photograph? What's that? What's a photograph anyway? Or perhaps they called it a daguerreotype. They used to call it a daguerreotype, yeah? So historians very excited about having different kinds of things that we have. Going on to the Second Reform Act. Considerably bigger. 2 million men altogether. The Second Reform Act, again, and I think you could mention this if you were commenting an extract from Macaulay, again, the Second Reform Act led to enormous riots around the country. It was very, very difficult to pass the bill. You had another national political crisis. Not so much for the Third Reform Act, 1884. And then, of course, as you know, in order to win the right to vote for women, c'était tout un tralala, comme on dit en termes techniques. It was very difficult. Listen, thank you for listening so carefully. It's 7 minutes to, but I'm exhausted, so I'm going to stop there. And I will see you next week for some more.